Valerie and I'm an addict.
I'm
what a great convention. I am so glad I'm here. A couple of nights ago, I was talking to Debbie on the phone, and you know, every time Debbie speaks, I never get to go. For some reason, I'm too far away, or I can't get off, or whatever, and here I was making another excuse why I couldn't come, and I live in St. Augustine, Florida, and I was saying, God, I need a convention so bad. I wish I'd planned to come, but I think I need vacation time. And, you know, I hung up that phone that night, and I thought, you know what? When I was using, did I think, do I have vacation time? No. If there was a drug somewhere, I was on my way. I don't care if I got a minute of sleep or didn't get no sleep or went straight there, came straight back, went right back to work. You know, and I thought, this is so silly. I need to go. And I want to tell you a little bit about Debbie. And I want to tell all the newcomers that got up, and that was so awesome, a little bit about sponsoring people and a little bit about what sponsorship means. You know, I moved to St. Augustine 4 years ago from Springfield, Missouri. And I went through a lot. Yay. And I went through a lot of stuff moving because, you know, I got clean in Springfield, Missouri. And that was the only place I'd ever been clean. And I made this great move, and I moved far away from my whole support system. And I want to tell you what sponsorship means to me. You know, I had a couple of sponsees, and one of my sponsees, two of my sponsees said, yeah, I still want you as a sponsor, even though you're moving far away. But one of my sponsees really kept me as a sponsor. I mean, she called me, she was on the phone to me, we were doing the thing long distance, and that was Debbie. And as a sponsor, you know, we may think that we're doing something for them, but let me tell you something, they're doing it for us. Because, you know, if it hadn't been for Debbie these last 4 years, I don't know where I'd be. But, you know, she's on that phone to me, and we're working steps, and we're talking about stuff, and she's picking up the phone and calling me all the time. And one of the things that really hits me all the time is that when I've got sponsees, if they're not working a strong program, you know, I'm real selfish, and they're gone. Because, you know, I'm real selfish, and you're keeping me clean. You know, and that's kind of how I've done it for a long time. And I'm real blessed to have Debbie as a sponsee because she really works her program. And whenever Debbie calls me, you know, I have to really get myself out of my stuff and I have to think on a higher level so that I can sponsor her, you know, and that always gets me up. It always brings me out of my stuff and brings me up to a higher level. And I am so completely blessed to be here with her and to hear her story. Thank you so much.
I'm Debbie. I'm an addict.
Hey.
I am nervous.
Yeah, whatever.
Oh, yeah. I get so much compassion here. I really appreciate it. Yeah, I'm feeling the love. And I took my shoes and socks off. I hope you don't mind. I really thought I'd get up here and make it through all that with my boots and everything on. And at the last minute, I went, screw it. I'm kind of a hippie at heart, so what the hell? I'll just be up here barefoot. Holy shit, there's a lot of clean time in this room. What do you think of that? And a lot of people. There's so much stuff I want to say. I want to start with a few things about just about how special it is for me to be here. Here in Asheville, North Carolina at this convention. I am so grateful to the committee for asking me to come and share. Tracy, where have you gone? There she is. I love you. Thank you. Thank you, Tracy. You have been so easy to work with to get me here and work out all the details, and I really, really appreciate it. And my sponsor showed up here and surprised me. I didn't know she was coming. And so I got up this morning, and there's messages and stuff, and I'm checking my phone, and she's going, Debbie, I need you to call me. I need you to call me. Call my cell phone. So I call her up, and she said, listen, I just wanted to let you know that I will not be at home this afternoon when you call me, because we'd made plans. I was going to call her before I came to speak, and I said, oh, really? Why is that? Where are you going to be? She said, at the convention in Asheville. And she was already here, so that was really cool. But, you know, I kind of had this weird little inkling. I told my boyfriend about a week ago. I was like, you know, I wonder if she might just show up in Asheville and surprise me. And but then I kind of thought she wasn't going to do that at all. So anyway, she's here, and that's good, and we're all here. And let me tell you what. I came to Asheville, North Carolina, the very first time 5 years ago, chasing this band around that I love. And they do this, I love rock stars. I kind of think I am one, but I'm an NA rock star. In my own mind, really. It's in my own mind, but that's okay. Anyway, I came out here for this big show that happens every year, and I fell in love with this place, as so many people do. I truly fell in love with this place. I fell in love with the space of it and the energy of it and the mountains and all of it. And I hadn't even been to NA yet. And then when I got to the fellowship, when I first started going to some meetings, which was actually, I think, about a year later, I'll tell you what, I was just, I went back, I brag on this place all the time. People from Missouri probably think, why don't you shut the hell up and go move there? You know, we're tired of hearing about Asheville, North Carolina. But, you know, I went home and told them, I said, you know, the fellowship out there is awesome. And they're like, really, what's it like? And I said, well, you know, they're like us, only more mature. Really, I still tell them that. Well, you know, you ain't been to meetings in my town yet, so how can you say? So anyway, that's about that. And you know, I just want to say that, you know, during that clean time countdown, when people were getting up, especially like when people got up for a year clean, I had this flash in my memory of having a year clean and standing up at a clean time countdown and looking at all the people with 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years. And to me, that was just monumental. And I remember, though, that once I got a year clean, I knew I was all in. I was all in here, and I wasn't going back out there. And I remember being in those clean time countdowns and seeing those people and thinking, someday I'm going to get a lot of clean time like that, too. You know, and so I just want to say to everybody, no matter where you're at in your clean time, we all get it exactly the same way, one day at a time. You know, and that's how I've got it. Sure, I'm glad John gave me the stone to hold, because, man, I'm just nervous. I'll get over that eventually, hopefully. You know what? I got here a lot like everybody else. I used for 21 years. Let's see. Usually I preface some stuff first because when I was new and I used to go to speaker meetings, there were things I tried to figure out about the speaker. Like, how long have they been clean? How old are they? Are they married? Do they have kids? Those are all the shit I tried to figure out. So I'm 45 years old. I'll have my clean date is March the 2nd, 1994. And, yeah, it impresses the shit out of me, too. Thanks. And I'm not married. I am in a relationship for 9 months now, and I'm very happy with that. So, and I've got a couple of kids, and so let's clear up all that stuff. All right, so anyway, I got high, and I got high a lot. I started using, when I was 13 years old, I started hacking gas. And, you know, it's really hard for me to remember how that came about. There were some girls that were a little bit older than me, and I think they told me about it or something, and that you'd get high. And, you know, I didn't even know what high was, but I wanted to do it. That's an act, you know? And, you know, I went from you know, within a very, very short amount of time, I went from being a straight-A student and a pretty decent kid to, you know, I remember bringing a red, bright red 5-gallon gas can in the house, and it sat at the foot of my bed at 13 years old, you know, and that should have been my first clue, but I didn't really know anything about the disease of addiction. What still astonishes me to this day was that nobody in the house said anything about that gas can sitting at the foot of my bed. So that's kind of a weird thing. I mean, you know, if one of my kids had a gas can in the house at the foot of the bed, I'd be like, what are you doing? I mean, I was smoking cigarettes at the time, for crying out loud. But anyway, that was how it all started. And, you know, and then I started smoking pot, and I loved pot. And you know, pot was the very last drug I used. And it has taken me a lot of years to understand, you know, because it was really hard for me to see that pot was a big problem, even though I got busted for selling it. I got busted for having it. I mean, you know, it did cause a lot of problems, and I certainly did a lot heavier drugs in a lot more extreme ways, but I loved pot. And, you know, any time today that I have ideas about using, it's always about smoking pot. It just, you know, I remember calling this woman up in NA years back, and I remember telling her, you know, I think I just want to go smoke some pot. And she said, well, how do you think that'll be different than it's ever been before? And I said, well, you know, when I got here, I didn't have any self-esteem, and you know, my life was shit, didn't know how to pay bills, get up, go to work. I can do all that stuff now, you know, and so I don't really see that it's going to be an issue. And she said, we have a word for that in Narcotics Anonymous. And she was kind of a proper lady, and she said, that word is baloney. And I said, all right. She was my grand sponsor at the time, But, you know, I've really struggled with that issue. So if you're struggling with that issue, you need to know that you're not alone, you know. And it took me a long time to be able to talk to people about that because it just, I don't know. Like, I got this thing in my mind about the NA rules, you know. Like, and nobody made the rule. I made the rules in my mind, and I try to rebel against them. So I don't really know. Anyway. I got loaded. I got high a lot. I copped a couple of felonies. I went to jail a lot. I had kids along the way. I caused a lot of harm to other people and myself, you know, through all of that. And it was an awful, horrifying existence at the end, you know. And I won't say that all my using was bad. It wasn't. I had a lot of fun. That's why I kept doing it, you know. And it took me to this place, you know. It took me out of me for a while because, you know, when I was a little kid and all hell was breaking loose in my house, I was doing things even then to escape. I was over in the corner of a room with a book, you know, and I didn't catch all that stuff that was going on in the room because I had found a way to get away from it, you know, and my world was all about fantasy. It was always about fantasy. I remember just making up all this stuff in my mind, you know, as a child. And I realized very recently, just a few weeks ago, that I still kind of have a serious problem with that. No, really. I mean, you know, it's kind of funny, but it was kind of devastating to me to figure it out because I thought I had a pretty good grip. In some areas of my life, I don't think I do. So anyway, it's good that I'm aware of it. I can start getting honest with my sponsor about it. You know, it's hard to get honest with your sponsor if you don't see it happening and you don't think it's a big problem. But anyway, that's kind of the way my life went. And, you know, I remember a time when, you know, when I think back on the horrors of addiction, for me, the very worst, the pinnacle of it for me, and there were many of these times when I would be in a bathroom for hours with blood running down my arm, trying to find a vein to do a shot of dope that wasn't going to work anyway, and crying because I wanted to die and I couldn't do anything any better than that. That was the best I could do, you know, and my daughter being on the other side of that door crying, saying, Mommy, are you okay? And that's the kind of shit that keeps me clean today, you know. And that's why I know I can't go smoke that joint. because it's a gateway for me. And I relapsed a lot. I started getting clean the first time in 1989, and I wound up in this treatment center at 29 years old because I was about to die, and my family had coerced me into going there, and I'd been up long enough, I didn't have enough left to fight them, so I went. The brochure looked nice. And it was a very nice, expensive treatment center. And they told me a lot of cool stuff, like, hi. And I know some people here. I really like it here. It's kind of like going home. But they told me some real important things there. And what they told me was, go to meetings and get a sponsor and work the steps. You know, and get in, get involved. And you know what? I didn't do that right away. I didn't do that for a long time. My story for the next 5 years is about going in and out and in and out and in and out. And I must have picked up 100 key tags, white key tags, you know. And that was a very devastating time for me. You know, I knew there was something here that worked. I saw it working for other people. I didn't have a lot of faith that it was going to work for me because I thought I was different, you know, and I had a really hard time getting through that. And there were things they told me to do here that I didn't want to do, you know, and I would come in and I would get a white key tag and then I would go back out and get high, you know, and in the meantime, I had copped another felony and I'd had another baby. And, you know, let me tell you something. I came back here in 1992 at the direction of the courts, and I had a three-month-old child, and my other two children were not living with me because I was not capable of taking care of them, and I was barely able to take care of that baby. But I came in, and they were sending me to meetings, and I came in with an attitude and a paper to be signed, and I sat in the back of the room pissed off, and you know, what I know today is that I was terrified. But, you know, I was so not in touch with that when I got here. All I knew was I was pissed off. And I was one violent, angry woman, you know, when I came in here. And that was one of the first things I had to learn in order to stay clean was to stop hitting people, because I used to hit people all the time. And I didn't care if it was a man or a woman or one of my kids or your windshield. You know, I mean, I was just violent and crazy and just, you know, that's the way my life went. And I ran with people that were just as crazy as me, if not crazier, you know, and I have to talk about that a little bit. I talked about that recently, but I need to talk about that again, about one of the things, you know, about me coming to terms with me taking responsibility for the stuff that happened in my life. You know, when I got clean, in particular, I had been in a couple of very, very abusive relationships where I got beat up a lot, you know, and for a long time, I never saw that I played a part in that. It was all about what they did to me. And through some very honest inventory, you know, I found out some things. And one of the things is that neither one of those people held me hostage, ever. I stayed there for very self-centered reasons. One time it was a drug dealer, and another time it was because of my fear of economic insecurity. And that's why I stayed there, you know, and not wanting to be alone. And the other part of that I had to come to own was that half the time when I got beat up, I threw the first punch, you know, and just because they were bigger than me and could kick my ass did not give me the right to be abusive to them, you know. And so... But, you know, for me, there is so much freedom for me in being able to own my stuff. Because if I'm a victim, then I got no solution. Because I'm not responsible for a solution. But when I can own my part, that gives me the freedom to seek a solution and to live it. You know, and that's brought me a long ways in Narcotics Anonymous. And I'm very grateful for the steps and the sponsorship that I've found here. And I've had some wonderful, wonderful sponsors that have taught me some very, very important things. So, well, let's see. The last time I got loaded, I had been coming here nonstop for a couple of years, pretty much. I'd been going to meetings all the time. And I was in a pretty sick relationship, and I was probably the sickest one in the relationship. But I was definitely not working a program. And what I did was I had a home group, and I did a lot of service work, and I obsessed on this relationship. And I started getting high. I relapsed and come back and got a white key tag. And, you know, and then it happened again about 6 months later. And that time I didn't tell anybody. And that time I didn't pick up a white key tag. And I kept getting high. And I would go to meetings and I would do certain shit. I was the GSR of my home group. I was the vice chair of H&I. I don't know what, I think I was even like sponsoring somebody. And, you know, I was doing a bunch of stuff, but I was not clean. You know, I would go to meetings and then I would go home and get high. And, you know, that was my worst bottom. And it wasn't about going to jail and losing stuff and all that other stuff, because none of that stuff happened the last time. But what happened was I was breaking my own heart on a daily basis, and I was kicking my own ass over what I was doing. And so all I can tell you is, if that's going on for you right now, trust the love in this fellowship and get honest, because that will kill you. So I got loaded again for the last time on March the 1st, 1994, and I drank some whiskey and I smoked some pot, you know, and I got up the next morning and it was just, it was the most hopeless, empty feeling I've ever had. Any of those bottoms, any of those times, it just, you know, what I felt was everybody in here is getting this deal. And I just can't seem to get it, you know. And I called this woman from back in my region. Oh, no. First, I have to tell you where I'm from. I meant to say that. My home group is the Bearing No Name group. And we meet on Saturday nights at 10 o'clock. I'm from the Southwest Missouri area in the Show Me region. And I'm very proud of that. So this woman back in my region, they'll be mad at me if I don't say that. That's why. So this woman back in my region, I called her, and I had known her since my first trip through NA, and I called her up, and I was crying, and I was like, man, I got loaded, and now I got to give up all these service positions. I mean, that's all I was really concerned about at that point. And she said, good, now maybe you'll start working a recovery program instead of a service program. And then after you get some recovery, you can do some real service in Narcotics Anonymous. But, you know, you need to have some kind of foundation here. And you know, so that's what I did. And I decided the last time that I came back, I decided that I was going to attempt to do everything that was suggested instead of just what I thought I needed to do. And one of the things I did that worked really, really well for me was that I would call somebody before I got high. And that worked really, really well for me. Because I would never do that before. People would be like, why didn't you call? Because I wanted to fucking get high. Why do you think I didn't call? Ain't calling you. Blow my buzz. I grew up in NA to become one of those buzz killers. And I'm very proud of it. Anyway, so I started doing that. And I went to meetings, and I went to meetings every day. I went to meetings every day for a very long time. You know, and I started talking about it when I felt like I wanted to get high. And I worked the steps past step three. That was a pivotal point for me, the very first time that I did an honest and thorough four-step. It has changed my life, and it was probably the most kind and loving thing I had ever even thought about doing for myself up to that point, you know. And the fourth step gets a bad rap. Man, I'm just like going, four step, try six and seven, eight, nine, shit, I got a four step. Man, I already know what I did. And geez, it's like, that's not new information, okay? The stuff in the four step, that's not new information. I've been packing that around for a long time by the time I get here. You know, I know a lot about that four step, but anyway, so just do it, you know, just do it. So I did those things, you know, I was working steps with a sponsor and going to meetings and just learning how to live one day at a time without getting high, how to get through one day and not get high, because that's really all it takes to stay here. You know, I mean, you do all this other stuff, but, you know, the deal is don't use no matter what. And my whole story is all about don't use no matter what. It really is. I mean, it's about we don't ever, ever, ever have to get high again over anything. I don't care what it is. So I was doing some things differently, and some things hadn't changed. Right about the time I finished working my first six step, and I had about 4.5 months clean, and I was insane. Insane. And this guy that I'd been with this relationship thing with, and we had broke up, and I was stalking this man. Really. Really. I mean, I was. I was literally stalking this man. I remember several nights, he would go to this place for coffee and he'd stay there like all fucking night long. And I remember sitting across the street in a parking lot with a pair of binoculars. That is a true story. And you know what? I learned an awful lot about the disease of addiction through that stuff. You know, that it really ain't just about the drugs. Drugs are a nice little symptom that get us in here and show us what we really need to work on. But it really wasn't all about the drugs for me. But I remember driving home one morning about 5:30 in the morning to get my teenage daughter up to go to school, and I remember feeling ashamed and hopeless and disgusted and real powerless, you know, and that's when I really started getting a grip about, you know, what this disease is really about, you know. And there were some events that transpired, and I eventually, with the help of my sponsor and some step work, was able to stop doing that behavior. And I haven't stalked anybody since. That was a long time ago. And I'm glad I've been stalked. I've been stalked. And so now I know how that feels too. It's okay. It's all right. So I spent some time alone. And one of the things that I learned about, you know, because I would segue my relationships with men, it was just one big long segue. You know, I normally would not get out of one until I had another one lined up. And it really was just literally like that. I mean, we're talking 24 to 48 hours difference, sometimes the same day. I mean, it was really just, it was sick. And it was on and on and on and on and on for years. And in the meantime, I had these kids, and I drug them through all that stuff with me. So, you know, it was suggested to me to spend some time alone and start figuring some things out and start working on myself and becoming comfortable with living with myself, and then maybe I wouldn't feel the need to keep pulling somebody in just so I didn't have to be alone. And one of the things that I figured out when that was going on and I was working on that step was that I, because of some events that had happened when I was a child, I was terrified of something happening to me in the middle of the night. And so I was terrified to be alone in a house at night at 34 years old. But, you know, it took being alone long enough and doing some step work to start uncovering some of that stuff so that I could work on it. And I worked on that, and that was very painful, and that was a very hard time for me. And but I had this friend. I had this friend, New York Danny, that had been clean for a long time, and he was a tech at a treatment center, and he worked midnights. And so when I'd get really freaked out, I could call him on the phone and talk to him, and he would talk me through it. And eventually I got to where I could comfortably be alone in the house at night. You know, and those are the things that, you know, if I kept using and I kept staying in sick relationships, how was I going to find that stuff out? You know, so I did some of that stuff. And then, you know, I did eventually get into another relationship with someone that had been a friend of mine for a very long time. And when I had 2.5 years clean, we had gone to a world convention, and we came home and we picked up my youngest daughter, who was 4, and the other kids weren't there, and we picked her up and we went home. And the next morning we woke up to the smoke alarm going off. And she had started a fire in our house. And, we got her out of the house, and we went to the hospital, and it was bad. It was really bad. She was burned over 94% of her body. And we went to the burn unit, and they put me off in this little room with a phone, and they took her back into the emergency room. And, you know, I got this thing going on with my sponsees right now. You know, everybody's got cell phones, and we got everybody's number programmed in these cell phones. Go ask somebody what so-and-so's phone number is, and 9 times out of 10, they can't tell you. You know, and I got this thing with my sponsees right now. I've been hammering them all. You memorize my phone number. You know, because when the shit hits the fan and you don't have a cell phone in your hand, you damn well better know your sponsor's phone number. You know, and and so they put me in that room, and I called my mother, and I called my daughter, my oldest daughter, and I called my sponsor. And in about 15 minutes, addicts started coming, and we had about 50 people up in that in the burn unit in the waiting room. And you know, we went through that day, and my mind just kept screaming, "This is not happening. This is not happening. This happens to people that I do not know. This is not happening." And, you know, the day wore on, and it just kept getting worse and worse. And she was bleeding to death internally. That's what was going on. And they had her on a ventilator, and it was breathing for her, and that was basically the only thing keeping her alive. And she was, the way it was explained to me, she was drowning in her own blood. And you know, I adored that child. I was more present for her than my other two kids. And it's not that I loved one more than the other, but I had a totally different experience with her because I had been able to really be present with her, you know, and be her mother. And late that afternoon, the doctor came to me, and he told me he had no hope for this child. And, you know, I hadn't gone there. I hadn't gone there at all. It never occurred to me that she would die. It never did. And, you know, he started talking to me about what's the most kind and loving thing to do. And he started talking to me about turning off the machines. And I was like, no, no. And I had gone back to see her at one point after that, after a couple of those conversations, and she had this drop of blood coming out of her nose, and you know, and I knew that the reason I was keeping her alive was for me. It wasn't for her. And I made a decision to let her go. And she died in my arms. And I can tell you that That's the most pain I've ever been in my life. You know, I hear people talking about, my worst day clean is better than my best day using. Not me. Not me. That's not my experience. But I can tell you that you can stay clean through it. You know, you can stay clean through it. And you know, I'll tell you what, my world was just literally flipped upside down. You know, my daughter died in my arms. I was not wearing my own clothes. I had no home to go to. Everything was just pew, just like that. And it can happen just that quick, just that damn quick. Life shows up, you know, and there are some real tragic, horrible, awful things that happen sometimes when we're clean. They just do, you know, and it's not necessarily about we're doing anything right or we're doing anything wrong. You know, because my deal up to that point was, you know, I remember being really, really angry when my daughter died. And her name was Cheyenne. I just want to say that. Her name was Cheyenne. But I remember being really furious when Cheyenne passed away and thinking, you know what? I was doing everything I was supposed to be doing. You know, I was working steps. I wasn't breaking law anymore. I had actually gotten a GED. I was going to college. I was being a good mom. I was working. I was helping other people. I was doing service work. You know, on and on and on. I was doing all this stuff. And, you know, I had to really revamp what the promise was that I got here. The promise was freedom from active addiction. And but you know what? Somewhere in the back of my mind, I think there was going to be a payoff. You know, if I did all the right stuff, then bad shit wouldn't happen to me. And that's just not the way it goes. You know, and it's very unfortunate. But I can tell you that I learned some huge, huge things from that. And because people were there were people calling me that I never even met before from other parts of the United States. That another addict that knew me had knew somebody, and they called somebody, and you know, they called me. People that had that experience, they would call me, and they would say things to me that would help me just hang on just a little bit more. Because, you know, for a long time, I didn't think about getting high. What I really wanted to do was blow my brains out. It hurt to take a breath. It literally just hurt to breathe, and that didn't go away in a few months. It took years for that to get better, you know, and I just stayed in here and I kept doing what people told me to do. And, you know, my experience and staying clean through that, you know, that doesn't make me special or different or nothing. I mean, all I did was follow direction. You know, I was just some rebellious, angry, dope fiend, crazy ass chick when I got here, you know, and it wasn't like I had any special power to do anything different than anybody else. That was all stuff that people gave me real solid direction on what to do. And, you know, I got to tell you, the ARMS and Narcotics Anonymous were right there for me when I walked out of that room that night. They were right there for me, and they never left me. You know, they've never left me. And people told me things. You know, my sponsor at the time was very good about giving me real solid direction. And she said, you know, go to meetings, sit in the chair. You know, if you feel like throwing the coffee pot through the window, you share that. You know, and I got really good at being real honest about what I shared. You know, it was no longer about saving face and looking good. I mean, most days I didn't even get any makeup on. I was doing good to get out of bed and get my clothes on. You know, but that's what I did, and I kept doing that. And I remember she showed up at my house. We'd gotten another house, and people in NA went and salvaged stuff out of our old place because I never walked back into that house. And she came into my home, and I was, you know, I was starting to turn into this real bitter, angry, hateful woman. And I didn't know what else to do. You know, that was all I could do. Because I was so pissed at God. You know, I didn't feel like God caused that, but I knew he could have fucking stopped it. You know, and I didn't understand. And I didn't want to pray, and I didn't want to have nothing to do with God. You know, just fuck God. That's what I said. You know, but God's all over our steps. And this woman, she walked into my house, and she gave me a little bit of a break. And I just finished a 10th step right before all that stuff happened. So you know where that left me. Step 11. Same one I'm on today, as a matter of fact. Hey, and I like it a lot better this time. She came into my house, and she said, you know, she had a notebook and her basic text. And she said, I said, what are you doing? She said, we're going to work the 11th step. And I said, no, we're not. And she said, yes, we are. I said, look at me. Look at my life. Look around me. Do you think I give a damn about that 11th step? And she was just like that far from my nose. And she said, I'm going to tell you something. You go get a pen and a piece of paper and your book. And you sit down at that table. Because the 11th step is the only thing that's going to save your fucking life. Yeah. So being the good little rule follower I am, I went and got my stuff and we worked the step. Actually, she was just pretty intimidating and I didn't want to argue with her. But, you know, she was like a pit bull. But she was also very loving. You know, and you know what? She knew this book inside out. And back then, we didn't have any step guides. We didn't have It Works How and Why, none of that stuff yet. And the way that she worked steps with me was we literally worked them together. She sat down at the table with me. She had her notebook. I had mine. We went through the book line by line, and we worked the step together. And that's the way we worked the 11th step that day. And you know, then when she left, you know, she left me with some things to do on my own to further continue working that step. And, you know, I had a breakthrough at that point. And I decided, I kind of made this deal with God, like I think I'm in charge of all this, but I kind of made this deal with God. And I just said, you know what? Okay. You know, I will walk with you again. And someday you're going to give me some answers, you know. And maybe that'll happen, maybe it won't. But it made me feel better, and I did what I needed to do. And I can tell you that my relationship today with my higher power is huge. It's huge. And I trust God implicitly. Implicitly. And I no longer believe that the universe is out to get me. But that's what I thought for a long time, you know. And I don't believe that anymore. You know, so I went through that, and it was years, and it was a lot of hard times. I learned an awful lot about living in the moment. I can live in the moment, let me tell you. Because, you know, at that point in my life, there was so much pain. You know, there was no going back, and I couldn't bear the idea going forward. And really, all I had was just that moment, and I learned a lot about staying in it, about being able to live in the moment. And I learned an awful lot about what's important and what's not, you know. And I learned a lot about caring about other people, and I learned a lot about telling them that, you know, and not letting those moments go by. Another thing that developed for me at that time that wasn't so healthy. I developed this huge, insane fear for my other two children that were still alive. And I had to know where they were and who they were with at all times in order to feel okay. And that went on for a long time, many, many years. It's been a little over 9 years since Cheyenne passed away. You know, I've gone through this stuff with my kids, and am I doing that?
No.
Okay, good. And, you know, eventually those things have gotten better. And it's a good thing that I've had a lot of practice in that, because both my kids wound up using My daughter's clean today. My daughter's got 10 months clean. My son, on the other hand, I pray for my son all the time. My son turned 19 in jail a couple of months ago, and they let him out and gave him one more chance, another chance among the many. And I think he made it about 5 days. And he's running from the law and doing all the stuff we do. I got a call from him a few days ago and gotten his nose broken the night before and, you know, just all that stuff. I've been on a real intense journey with my son. And, you know, I know I have the right sponsor. Our lives parallel. We both got these sons that do these crazy ass things. And, She said that whenever I call her and something's new is going on with my son, she just kind of braces herself because hers is probably getting ready to spin off the deep end too. And that's kind of what they do. They just like follow this pattern. But, you know, it's an exercise for me every day to just trust God more, trust God more, trust God more, trust that they're on the path they need to be on, you know. I've gotten better about not doing anything because I did all these things for like 2 years. I mean, I spent thousands of dollars on treatment centers and recs and just everything you could imagine, everything, trying to help him get it. And you know, what I really needed to do was go back and read my own basic text. And it's really hard when it's your child. But, you know, the basic text talks about, you know, we can be beaten, locked up, begged, prayed over, all the shit that can happen, and we don't stop until we're ready to stop, you know. You know, and for me, a lot of it, too, getting really honest is about, you know, obviously I love my son, I adore my children, you know, I'm really afraid of having to go through that pain again, of losing another child. You know, I came to a place last year, and this was really a big deal for me, because I believe that there's a real fine line between grief and self-pity. And I was on either side of that line a lot of different times, but... you know, I have come to know a lot of peace over my daughter's death. And one of the things that came to me last year, and I was talking to my sponsor, and somebody had said something to me, somebody in the program, about what happened to me. And, you know, the words just came right out of my mouth. You know what? That didn't happen to me. That happened to her. I have a lot of feelings about it. That didn't happen to me. That happened to her. You know, and... I'm really grateful for everything I've gotten here. I've gotten so much stuff. You know, I want to talk about my sponsees a little bit because my sponsor has taught me an awful lot of things about being a sponsor. But I'm a firm believer that you cannot be an effective sponsor without first knowing how to be an effective sponsee. And, I do call my sponsor diligently, and she lives a long damn ways from me. I'm in Springfield, Missouri, and she's in St. Augustine, Florida. And I remember when she left 4.5 years ago, right around there, I was going through this awful, nasty, horrible divorce with somebody in the program in a real small fellowship. And I remember just like, holy shit. And then she told me she was leaving. And I was like, you can't leave. I'm in the middle of a fucking crisis. You ain't moving. But she did. And, you know, I'll tell you what. I have really dug my heels in and worked a program. And I'm a firm believer about being very consistent with my communication with my sponsor. whether anything's going on or not. Because what I find 9 times out of 10 when I call her up and it feels like nothing's going on, oh, some shit comes out in those conversations sometimes. You know, because I'm really good about stuffing and covering up and, you know, just, we still got a pretty good little denial system, even clean. You know, we can have about a lot of things. And so I'm really good about working with my sponsor and being honest with my sponsor. Because, you know, when I was first clean, that was really, really hard for me to tell somebody the shit that went through my mind that I didn't want to tell anybody, all those crazy little things about myself. And I'm a firm believer that that's the first place where the disease of addiction steps in, and I'm on my way to getting loaded if I don't start sharing that stuff. And that's still really, really true for me today. That's the stuff. That's the stuff that gets me. That's where the disease of addiction gets in there and just plays, you know. So I got these sponsees, and I love my sponsees. And someone told me a long time ago, if you got a sponsee, you better teach them everything you know about recovery, because there may come a day when you need them to give it all back to you. And so that's the way that I sponsor people. And but you know, for a long time, I did not sponsor newcomers. And I do not mean this in any kind of offensive way, but I just was not in a space spiritually. I just, to me, it was chaotic and crazy, and most of the ones I'd sponsored got loaded after driving me nuts for 3 months, and I was just like, man, let the ones that are a little below me sponsor them. You know what I mean? Like, if I got 5 years, let them 3-year people sponsor. You know, and that was kind of my attitude. And I'm not saying it was right, and I'm not saying it was wrong. It's just what I did. But, you know, about a year ago, this woman came to me and asked me to sponsor her. And she had 45 days clean. And my head went, uh-uh. And my mouth went, I'd be honored. And I'm looking around going, what did I just tell her that for? And you know what? This woman has been huge in my life. She has been monumental in my recovery. And she's made me dig in and learn more stuff. You know, she's made me really get up off it and give it to. They work you hard, the newcomers. If they stay clean, they'll work your ass off, man. And I was getting in a place of just, you know, I've hit places in recovery where I have felt just not so enthused and inspired. You know, just really things get monotonous. You know, when you've heard the same stuff in a meeting that you've heard about 8,200 times, you don't want to hear it anymore. You know, I mean, it just, that's where I get anyway, you know, but, I heard a guy say a long time ago, he said, you know what? My disease is not based on what I think or how I feel. My disease is based on, or not my disease, my recovery. He says, my recovery is based on what I do in spite of what I think and how I feel. And that's what a lot of my recovery has been about. I do a whole lot of shit I don't feel like doing. Still do, you know. And but the funny thing is once I open the door to this newcomer girl, now I got 5. They bring their own brand of insanity. They do. They're funny. But I love them, you know, and they adore me. You know, they just think I'm the shit. I could tell them the freaking sun is blue, and they'd be like, really? I mean, you know. It's kind of cool in a way. Taking a couple of them back tapes, they'll be going. Anyway, I got in a relationship last year after not being in one for a long time. Because I'll tell you, after that last divorce, it was a year and a half before I even went out on a date again. It burnt me. It burnt me really bad inside, and I, you know, I'm kind of an all or nothing person. Okay, that didn't work. Not doing that ever again. And that lasted for about a year and a half. And then I did start dating again. And, you know, there were a couple of people along the way on that journey that that taught me what it was like to be treated well. And in turn, taught me how to treat another person in a relationship. And so I got in this relationship about 9 months ago with somebody from AA.
Ooh.
Okay, everybody throw something at me now. That's good. I don't care. We've been teasing him all weekend, telling him he's the token alcoholic at the NA convention. Thank God he's got a good sense of humor. Well, actually, it was really kind of funny because he does, he has learned how to stand his own ground around us crazy-ass addicts. There was like seven of us at dinner one night, and somebody was telling the story about this speaker that spoke at the World Convention from Ireland, and he was talking about his dad had been in, he said, the OFF. And people were kind of looking at him, and he said, and for those of you who don't know what the OFS, the OFF is, that's the other fucking fellowship. So we were telling Larry about this at dinner one night, and we're all laughing, ha, 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 at his expense. And finally he looked up, and he goes, actually, that would be the original fucking fellowship. But anyway, I don't know how I got off on that tangent, but anyway, you know, it's actually been really cool. I mean, he's got his place to do his service and have his sponsor in his home group, and I've got mine, and you know, it works out real well for us, you know, it really, really does. But that's not really the part that I wanted to talk about. The part that I wanted to talk about was that, you know, through working the steps and being honest with myself and my sponsor and trusting a higher power, I've learned how to stick and stay. I've learned how to work through the tough shit, you know, and when I feel like I need to stand up for myself, I've learned to do it in a way that's loving and kind, you know, instead of just barreling through. I've learned that I don't always get my way, you know, and I've learned that he don't always get his way. You know, I have been through some of the toughest times trying to communicate in this relationship. And it gives me an opportunity on a real consistent basis to look at my own part. You know, because I get in this place where I want to pick apart everything he's doing wrong. I don't feel good, so it's your fault. And I know you're doing this and this and this. And that's what's making it all fucked up. And, you know, sometimes I go through that process first, you know, and then I get to a place of, wait a minute, what's my part here? You know what I mean? Because it's kind of this idea that perception is projection, you know, and if I'm thinking that you're ostracizing me, what I need to look at is what are the ways that I ostracize myself? You know, because that's where it's really all about. You know, me and Brack were having this conversation a couple months ago, and Brack said, yeah, it's kind of that idea, if you spot it, you got it.
Yeah.
And if it really upsets you, you probably got it really bad. And I really like that, you know. And it's true. I try to remember that, you know, that all of it, it's the same stuff they told me when I got here. You know, if there's something out there that's bothering me, I better be looking at me. You know, because the deal is, you know, it's not, and it talks about that in the basic text, you know, we found when we got here that what needed changing was not the world around us, but our perception of it, you know, and that still holds true for me today. And, you know, I don't know, there's lots of people in here with a lot of clean time, and I'm sure that I'm not the only person in the world that's, or in this fellowship that's ever felt this, but I know that the longer I stay clean, the trickier it gets.
Yes.
It gets tricky, you know, and it gets, sometimes that path is so tight and so narrow. And, you know, I remember I heard a guy say a long time ago, I think I had about 3 weeks clean or something, and I remember hearing this guy say, the longer you stay clean, the closer you are to getting high. And I remember looking at him going, Well, what the fuck is that about? And if that's true, why do I want to do it? You know? But I understand a lot about what he's talking about. You know, the disease shows up in so many ways. Shopping. Sugar. Starbucks. Big time. Men. Just whatever, you know. I can get really obsessed on lots of stuff. How long have I been talking, Deborah? A really long time? 61 minutes? Well, you're good. It's your job, right? To know how long I've been talking. All right. Well, you know, I want to talk a little bit about some things that have happened for me in the last couple of years, and then I'm going to think about wrapping this deal up. I have, you know, through my spiritual journey and then kind of half-assed by accident, I fell into this deal where I was able to have the opportunity to learn some really powerful, wonderful things and do some alternative healing. And, you know, that has been huge for me. And, you know, it's shown me a lot of things about my higher power that I didn't know I was ever going to know. You know, and the longer I stay clean, it's like I was talking about this a while back. You know, the first few years I was here, I had to struggle to feel God around me. I got glimpses of it, but I didn't have it very often. And I would look for it and struggle for it and wait for it and all that stuff. And, you know, today I feel that all the time. You know, and that's huge. You know, that's huge. I'm so overwhelmed sometimes, especially on clean dates. I get really overwhelmed when I think about, you know, who I was when I got here. You know, and for me to have 12 months, much less almost 12 years, it's just, do you understand how huge that is? I mean, it's just, and you know, it all starts with just some surrender and honesty. You know, if we can just keep coming back in here and listen to people and let people love us and, you know, don't use no matter what happens, you know, our lives get huge. They get huge and the possibilities are endless. You know, because I remember, you know, most of my trips in here were about getting a paper signed or maybe not stick a needle in my arm today. You know, and that's really all I expected to get here. I didn't expect to get a higher power. I didn't expect to be a responsible, productive member of society. I certainly never expected to be standing in front of a room of however many people are here telling my story. You know, I've been blessed. I've been blessed with so much just because I was willing to follow direction. I had a sponsee that said a while back, she said, you know, I finally understand that there's a really big difference between desire and willingness. Desire is I want to, willingness is I do, you know, and that's a big deal. I'm going to read this little something. That's my favorite little something. They're all really good. When we are willing to follow this course of action and take advantage of the help available to us, a whole new life is possible. In this way, we do recover. Today, secure in the love of the fellowship, we can finally look another human being in the eye and be grateful for who we are. Thank you.